Recently, the city of Austin suffered a setback in the promotion of its social agenda for the city when the voters of the city of Austin went out and approved Proposition 22, which basically did away with a city council ruling that happened prior to that, where the city council provided health benefits for domestic partners, that is, unmarried domestic partners of city employees. And the people of Austin went out and voted against that policy, and basically in doing that said that they did not believe that that policy of providing city funds to pay health care benefits for unmarried domestic partners was in keeping with the moral values and the ethical values of the city of Austin. And the media responded in astonishment. I don't know if you watched the news that evening or read the paper, but they were shocked that such a small, radical, yet vocal minority could actually become the majority in an election and overturn the wise thinking of the city council of Austin. They were shocked by that. And I guess for me, the shocking thing is not so much that that vote took place. In fact, for me, that the fact that this happened is not such a significant victory as it is a reminder of, on a day-to-day basis, how invisible the believers of this city are. The fact that we could muster a group of people to go out and vote against this particular ruling of the city council, to me, is fairly immaterial. The question is, why would the media be surprised? Have the believers of the city of Austin become so hard to find on a day-to-day basis that anybody would be shocked by this? Now, in places in the South, Austin would certainly rank pretty high on the pagan list. That is, Austin is not a typical Bible Belt city like many of the other cities in Dallas. And what I mean by that is the social fabric of this city, well, you all know what I mean by that, huh? The social fabric of the city is not necessarily biblical in its orientation, but I wonder, is it possible for the believers to just become almost invisible? And not just in the political arena. What about in our neighborhoods? What about in our schools? What about in our workplaces? Is there no significant, appreciable influence? And I'm not talking about just influence to push our social agenda, but I'm talking about the influence of God in people's lives as we believers carry God into the places of life. Could it be that we've become invisible? When you look at the biblical passage we're going to look at today, we find another city that's similar to Austin. And the name of that city is the city of Sodom. So, well, Austin is not where they are, and that's probably true, but there's another city, and there's a man living in that city that's become invisible. Now, of all the things there are to see in Sodom, there's one thing that you will probably have difficulty seeing if you go there, and that is, you'll have trouble seeing Lot, because Lot has become so close to the culture of his city that he's become invisible. And I wonder if you looked at the city of Austin, of all of the things that are going on here, and you look around the city of Austin, do you see believers having an appreciable impact on the city? I fear at times that we have become almost invisible. Now, my goal is not to promote political action on the part of our people, because I don't think political action in and of itself will ever change the world. The world has changed when people are changed by coming to faith in Jesus Christ. That's how the world has changed. Are we making an impact? Would you even see us in the city of Austin if you took a bird's eye view? Turn in your Bibles to Genesis chapter 18. In Genesis chapter 18 and 19, we see the demise of a man who had all kinds of potential and lots of opportunities. And this is a very, very sad story. It's a sad story for a number of reasons. In fact, it may be one of the saddest stories in the Bible if you can ever get to the human level of this man Lot. He's so repulsive by his behavior and his actions that you almost can't see the man underneath all of this. But Lot started out with a pretty good shot at life. He started out being the nephew of the man God called in that particular culture to be his individual. You see, Lot was the nephew of Abraham. And Lot got to go to the promised land, and he was sharing in part of the promise. There came a time when a choice was made, and Lot and Abraham separated, and Lot picked a place to go to live his life, which became his demise. That choice will be played out in these chapters, and we'll see the result of his choice. Now, today we all make choices. And there are choices that we've made in the past that we look at the consequences of those choices today, and we say, man, if I would have ever known that this would be the result of that, I would have never done that. And yet today we're making additional choices for how we will live our life, and all of those will have impact on the future. In this passage, as we look at Lot, we are also going to see the main player. The main character, as always, is God. And we're going to learn two truths about God. The first truth is God always judges with justice. That's the kind of God he is. But God is also incredibly merciful in this passage. Notice verse 16 of Genesis 18. When the men got up to leave, they looked down toward Sodom, and Abraham walked along with them to see them on their way. Now, who are these men? We discovered earlier in the chapter that three people showed up to tell Abraham that he was going to have a son, Isaac. Of those three men, two of them are angels, and one of them is God himself, who makes a special appearance. And now those three men are walking toward the city of Sodom with Abraham, and this conversation takes place. Verse 17, then the Lord said, shall I hide from Abraham what I'm about to do? Abraham will surely become a great nation, great and powerful nation, and all the nations on earth will be blessed through him, for I have chosen him so that he will direct his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing what is right and just, so that the Lord will bring about for Abraham what he's promised him. Then the Lord said, now he's talking to Abraham, the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is so great, and their sin so grievous, that I will go down and see if what they have done is as bad as the outcry that has reached me. If not, I will know. The men turned away and went toward Sodom, but Abraham remained standing before the Lord. Now here in this passage, God is going to send his two angels down to Sodom to investigate, to see if things are really as bad as they appear to be. See if things are really as evil as they're supposed to be before God sends the judgment in. We see in this passage that God's not some kind of a loose cannon. That's not God's approach to judging. He's not the kind that hears a rumor that people are doing wrong and he flies off the handle and throws judgment on people. God's judgment is very calculating. And it's calculated on the basis of one principle, and that is justice. God never judges anybody in a way that they don't deserve. God is very cautious to always make sure that when he judges, he's meting out a punishment for a crime that has actually been committed. Now look at the terminology God uses to describe this. He says in verse 20, the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is so great. Now what is this outcry? We've seen this before. Remember back in Genesis chapter 4 when Cain killed his brother Abel? And God says, hey Cain, where's your brother? And Cain says to God, am I my brother's keeper? And God says, your brother's blood is crying out from the ground. Principle. God has created the universe with a sense of justice. God has set in motion his laws of justice, and crimes in this universe will be punished. And when somebody commits a crime, that injustice actually calls out to God as if screaming out from the ground. You ever think about that? Sometimes we sin in secret, thinking that nobody will ever know. And the very sin itself is calling hey God, look over here. An injustice has been committed. A sin has been committed. And rumor has it in the courts of heaven that Sodom is so bad that their sins are knocking at the door of heaven demanding that God come down and judge them. Demanding that. So God's going to investigate. He says, I'm going to go down and see if what they have done is as bad as the outcry that has reached me. If not, I will know. I'm not going to just fly off the handle and waste these people on a whim. I'm going to check this thing out. And so he's going to send his angels to go down there and find out what's going on. God is the kind of God who judges, but his judgment is always, always just. Now, Abraham, in his own way, has a strong desire to preserve the city of Sodom because he's got a vested interest in it. If you remember back in chapter 14, Abraham saved the city of Sodom and Gomorrah. Remember when they were captured and carried into captivity and Abraham marshaled his troops and they got together and they went and rescued them and brought them back? Not only that, but Abraham's nephew Lot and his family are in the city of Sodom. And so Abraham begins to negotiate a deal with God to try to save the city. It's a great negotiation. Abraham's really good at this. He's a great negotiator. Watch how he does it. Verse 23. Then Abraham approached him and said, will you sweep away the righteous with the wicked? What if there are 50 righteous people in the city? Will you really sweep it away and not spare the place for the sake of 50 righteous people in it? Far be it from you to do such a thing, to kill the righteous with the wicked, treating the righteous and the wicked alike. Far be it from you, will not the judge of all the earth do right? Question, God, will you indiscriminately waste the righteous people in order to get the people that are sinners? I mean, are you just going to wipe out everybody in the face of the righteous people that are there? If there are 50 righteous people, will you spare the city? Notice what God says. The Lord said, if I find 50 righteous people in the city of Sodom, I will spare the whole place for their sake. Then Abram spoke up again. Now that I have been so bold as to speak to the Lord, though I am nothing but dust and ashes, what if the number of the righteous is 5 less than 50? Will you destroy the whole city because of 5 people? Very good reasoning. He turns the argument around. You wouldn't destroy it for 50 people, would you? Well, for 5? I mean, just because 5 are missing, I mean, you wouldn't destroy a whole city over 5 people now, would you? Notice God says, if I find 45 there, he said, I will not destroy it. Once again, he spoke to him, what if only 40 are found there? He said, for the sake of 40, I will not do it. Then he said, my Lord, or may the Lord not be angry, but let me speak. What if only 30 can be found there? He answered, I will not do it if I find 30 there. Now, the problem is that when you get in a bartering session with God, you got to keep in mind that he probably knows not only the cards that are in his hand, and the cards that are in your hand, but he also knows the cards that are still in the deck. I mean, God knows everything. And he's negotiating for people that don't exist. There are not 30 people in the city that are righteous. There are not 20 people, as we'll see in a few minutes. Verse 31, Abraham said, now if I have been so bold as to speak to the Lord, what if only 20 can be found there? And he said, for the sake of 20, I will not destroy it. Then he said, may the Lord not be angry, but let me speak just once more. What if only 10 can be found there? He answered, for the sake of 10, I will not destroy it. When the Lord had finished speaking with Abraham, he left, and Abraham returned home. Now, in this case, God knows how many people that are there in the city. Abraham doesn't. He's making assumptions. He says, you know, Lot's there and his wife, that's 2. Lot's got at least 2 daughters that are engaged to be married, so that's at least 2 more, and their husbands. So, you know, that's 2 more on top of that, and he's got 2 unmarried daughters, so there's 2 more. And I mean, there's probably some kids in here, and there have to be a few people that when they saw me defeat Chedorlaomer in chapter 14, and we came back and remember when Bera, the king of Sodom, and Melchizedek showed up, and we praised El Elyon, the God the Most High, and we said this victory was won because of God, and it was obvious because we only had a few hundred men, and we beat this whole army, and I mean, God did the victory. There had to be some people that believed. I mean, there's got to be at least 10 wrong. There's not going to be 10. And furthermore, God is not going to sweep away the righteous with the wicked, even if it's only one. The judge of the earth is so good at meting out judgment on the sinners and at preserving the righteous that God will save the person and judge the city. In Abraham's mind, you can't do both. God's justice is always perfect. He's always just. Now, does the city deserve to be judged? Let's go to chapter 19. Two angels arrived at Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting in the gateway of the city. When he saw them, he got up to meet them and bowed down with his face to the ground. "My lords," he said, "please turn aside to your servant's house. You can wash your feet and spend the night and then go on your way early in the morning." Now, Lot knows something about the place that he lives in. And he's very protective of these two strangers. "You can come stay with me. I'll take care of you. And then you can leave early in the morning." Now, why? "No," they answered, "we'll spend the night in the square, as would be customary for people traveling through town." But he insisted so strongly that they did go with him and entered his house. He prepared a meal for them, baking bread without yeast, and they ate. Before they had gone to bed, all the men from every part of the city of Sodom, both young and old, surrounded the house. They called to Lot, "Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us so that we can have sex with them." Lot went outside to meet them and shut the door behind him and said, "No, my friends, don't do this wicked thing. Look, I have two daughters who have never slept with a man. Let me bring them out to you, and you can do what you like with them. But don't do anything to these men, for they've come under the protection of my roof." "Get out of our way," they replied. And they said, "This fellow came here as an alien, and now he wants to play the judge. We'll treat you worse than them." They kept bringing pressure on Lot and moved forward to break down the door. But the men inside reached out and pulled Lot back into the house and shut the door. Then they struck the men who were at the door of the house, young and old, with blindness, so they could not find the door. This is an incredible passage. One of the things about the scripture is it presents the good and the bad. It presents the reality of human life as it really happens, and that's how it really happened in this city. These people were so perverted, and Lot was aware of that, of their perversion, that they were there at the door for the purpose of committing homosexual rape against two strangers that had come into town. That's incredible. But that's the nature of where the city was. Now, do you think that the city deserved to be judged? Do you think that the wickedness was as bad as God had heard? Absolutely. It's incredible as you look at the situation that's going on here. Lot offers them, in place of these two men, his two daughters, two virgin daughters, for them to get their pleasure with. Notice the way he says it. In verse 8, he says, "Look, I have two daughters who have never slept with a man. Let me bring them out to you, and you can do what you like with them." That phrase, "what you like," is literally translated from the Hebrew, which is, "you can do with them what seems good to you." In other words, the best Lot can do in this bad situation, the best he can provide, are his two daughters to be raped and abused by the men of this town. That's the best he can do. And he says, "You can do what seems good to you with them." And they say, "No, we're not interested in good." As bad as that good might be, we want bad. And we want the men who are in the house. Where in the world is Lot? What is this place? The city of Sodom. How could he live there? How could he tolerate this kind of behavior? Day after day, week after week, the fact that he's sitting at the gate of the city seems to indicate, by all intents and purposes, is that he's probably an important individual by now. He's been living there for a number of years. He came in with a lot of stuff cattle, sheep. He is bought in or become part of this city. The men of the city recognize him and see him. He's sitting out the gate of the city and he knows what goes on. This is not a private thing. Has he influenced the culture? Not at all. Has the culture influenced him? Well, you tell me, which one of you would turn your daughters out to a crowd like this? Has the culture influenced him? You better believe it. You better believe it. You know, sometimes when you take up residence and you buy in to the culture of this world, every solution is a bad one. And that's where Lot is. Every solution is a bad solution. And now he's trying to juggle what's worse between all of his options. And they're all bad. Notice what they say to him. Verse 9, get out of our way, they replied. And then they said, this fellow came here as an alien. Now, his uncle saved the city a few years before. They would all be speaking Akkadian right now had his uncle not saved the city. And now he's an alien. He's not one of us anymore. He stands up for righteousness. You know, sometimes when you buy into the ways of the world and you go along with it for years and years and years, and then finally you say, I've had enough. I'm going to put my foot down. I'm not going to do this anymore. I won't stand for this. What does the world say? Well, you've earned your right to speak here. And if you don't think this is good, we'll back off. Is that what the world says? Now, you never were one of us. You're an alien. And we'll do to you and worse if you don't let us do what we want to do. Hey, God's judgment is going to be just in this situation. And it's going to be obvious that it will be just. Now, let me do a little bit of an aside here. The issue of homosexuality is a hot issue in our society today. There are a few, not very many, but there are a few studies out there of some scientific nature that would move toward a genetic predisposition to homosexuality. There's a lot of propaganda out there coming from the homosexual community and basically the educated community promoting ideas about homosexuality. There are a few studies out there, like the one that appeared in the Austin American Statesman a few months ago, that stated that the population of homosexuals in the United States is somewhere between 1 and 3%. As opposed to the 10%, which has been promoted. Many other things that are floating around out there, and in the midst of all of that, we don't have time this morning to take that apart and deal with it. I don't think that this passage is specifically written and put in the text for the purpose of discussing homosexuality. I think this passage is talking about God's just judgment, God's mercifulness, and the fact that when we make choices, they affect the rest of our lives. However, this passage does deal with the issue of homosexuality. In fact, the act of a homosexual is called sodomy, named after the city of Sodom. In other words, the activities of these people will infamously be recorded throughout history and referred to in relationship to homosexual activities. The Bible says that homosexuality is wrong. Also says a number of other things are wrong. It clearly states that homosexuality is wrong. Leviticus chapter 18 puts homosexuality in the same category with incest and bestiality, and the punishment for that behavior, according to the Old Testament, is capital death penalty. You say, well, that's the Old Testament. You know, New Testament, we got grace and everything's better, right? Let me give you some passages. We don't have time to look them up this morning, but if you want to know whether homosexuality is considered a sin in the New Testament, let me give you some passages. Romans chapter 1, starting with verse 18 and following, makes it very clear that a degenerating society that is moving away from God will manifest itself in perversion, and part of that perversion is homosexuality. That when we move away from the Creator and His design for mankind, we will begin to adopt other styles of relating, other behaviors, other lusts, and among those, we will move away from the idea of a man and a woman married together in a sexual, spiritual, emotional family union forever, and move into other types of relationships. Among them would be a homosexual relationship. In addition to that, 1 Corinthians chapter 9 and verse, excuse me, chapter 6 and verse 9 and 1 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 10 all refer to homosexuality as a sin. So we've got at least three examples in the New Testament where it's clearly listed as a sin. Now, is homosexuality the worst sin a person can commit? I don't think the text teaches that. It's certainly one of them, but there are a number of sins that are committed every day by us, all of us, that are grievous in God's sight as homosexuality is. Does that mean homosexuals should be hated? We never hate people. We never hate people. The behavior, the lifestyle, it's abhorrent to God in the same way that all kinds of sin is abhorrent to God. It appears that the culture in which we live has chosen to define itself in what I would consider an incredible way. When people begin to identify themselves, to define their being on the basis of their sexual activities, where in the world are we as a culture? Where are we? When a person says, I am gay, and that's who I am, excuse me, you got to be kidding me. Is that what defines you? Your sexual practices. That's who you are? You've got to be kidding me. I think the Scripture is so strong on this, particularly in Romans chapter 1, because when people are so captivated by their physical passions that they begin to define their whole identity around their physical passions, when they begin to do that, you've lost all of a sense of who God is. And a relationship to community. Come on. What if I define myself as a chocoholic? Because I have a physical passion for chocolate. You've got to be kidding me. You say, well, sex is bigger than eating. Is it really? The reason why I point this out is because we have got to take a hard look at the world in which we live. And I think when we do, we're going to begin to find out that the culture that we live in is moving away from God at a rapid pace. And it's sad. It's not to hurl judgment. It's not to be angry at people. It's to grieve and be sad that people have lost so much of a sense of who God is and who they are and who the community is around them that they've begun to define themselves by their sexual activities. It's very sad. And we as a culture need to reach out in love, not condoning that lifestyle, but trying to touch the heart of a person that is so lost. And that's just one way that's expressed. It's okay to sit next to a guy at work that is involved daily in immorality and jokes about it around the coffee pot, and that's not a problem, though his life is completely defined by his sexual exploits, heterosexual though they might be. And then to be repulsed by a gay person because his life's defined that way, it's okay for us. But, you know, now we embrace the immorality person. We embrace the adulterer. That's okay. And soon we'll embrace the homosexual lifestyle as well, and that'll be okay too. And we just see the culture slipping and slipping and slipping. Focus is getting people to define their identity in their relationship to God, not in relationship to their passions. And the result of a culture that defines itself in relationship to its passions is it will become like Sodom and Gomorrah, and it will bring down the judgment of God on itself. In the midst of that, God is not silent. God is working in mercy to preserve the people who belong to Him. And we see that mercy in an incredible story here in how God deals with Lot. Look at verse 12. The two men said to Lot, "Do you have anyone else here sons-in-law, sons or daughters, or anyone else in the city who belongs to you. Now, who do they belong to if they don't belong to Lot? I mean, here's an issue of identity. Do they belong to the culture? Do they belong to this pagan crowd? Or do they belong to you, Lot? And you know what he's going to find out? That there are a lot less people in the city, even his own blood relatives, that don't belong to him anymore. They've sold out completely. And that's going to be a sad day. The man Lot made choices, and the fruit of those choices is going to be awful painful for him. Watch as he goes to try to pull his own in with him. Get them out of here, because we're going to destroy this place. The outcry of the Lord against its people is so great that he has sent us to destroy it. So Lot went out and spoke to his sons-in-law who were pledged to marry his daughters. He said, "Hurry and get out of this place, because the Lord is about to destroy the city." But his sons-in-law thought he was joking. "What's the matter with you, man? Lighten up. Never heard anything like this out of you before. I mean, all of a sudden you get all excited and preaching these hellfire and brimstone messages? I mean, back off, buddy. Leave us alone." Verse 15, with the coming of the dawn, the angels urged Lot, saying, "Hurry, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, or you will be swept away when the city is punished." When he hesitated, the men grasped his hands and the hands of his wife and his two daughters, and led them safely out of the city, for the Lord was merciful on them. God says, "Get out of the city, guys." He doesn't want to leave. He wants to stay. The angels literally grabbed he and his wife and his two girls that were at home by the hand and drug them out of the city to save them. And they don't even want to be saved. He's hesitating in the midst of all of this going to happen. Why? Because God's merciful. You know, sometimes God grabs us out of and drags us out of the midst of judgment, even when we like where we are. And here's an example of God dragging them out to save them, even though they'd rather be there, even though they don't want to leave. Lot continues to negotiate. As soon as he had brought them out, one of them said, "Flee for your lives. Don't look back. And don't stop anywhere in the plain. Flee to the mountains or you will be swept away." But Lot said to them, "No, my lords, please. Your servant has found favor in your eyes, and you have shown great kindness to me in sparing my life. But I can't flee to the mountains. This disaster will overtake me and I'll die. Look, here is a town near enough to run to, and it's small. Let me flee to it. It is very small, isn't it? Then my life will be spared." He said to him, "Very well, I will grant this request too. I will not overthrow the town you speak of, but flee there quickly, because I cannot do anything until you reach it. That is why the town is called Zor, meaning a little place." He says, "I can't make it all the way to the mountains. Hey, let me go to this small town," because God was going to wipe out more than just Sodom and Gomorrah. He was wiping out all the cities of the plains that all had this behavior. And there was one small city, and he said, "Well, at least let that city survive, and I'll go to that place, and I'll live there." The angel says, "Okay, well, we'll even grant you that wish." Verse 23, "By the time Lot reached Zor, the sun had risen over the land. Then the Lord rained down burning sulfur on Sodom and Gomorrah from the Lord out of the heavens. Thus he overthrew those cities and the entire plain, including all those living in the cities, and also the vegetation in the land. But Lot's wife looked back, and she became a pillar of salt." Verse 27, "Early the next morning, Abraham got up and returned to the place where he had stood before the Lord. He looked down toward Sodom and Gomorrah, toward all the land of the plain, and he saw dense smoke rising from the land like the smoke from a furnace. So when God destroyed the cities of the plains, he remembered Abraham, and he brought Lot out of the catastrophe that overthrew the cities where Lot had lived." Here we see God in his mercy drags Lot out of the city, tells him, "Don't look back, don't wish for the past." And Lot's wife couldn't do it. It wasn't just a peek over her shoulder. The text says she looked back, and the Hebrew word there, she looked intently. She probably shed a number of tears over the city, recognizing that she had family and friends there that were dying. And God said, "No," and she joined the ranks of those who were judged. She wanted to be there. She wanted to be with them. She wanted to be part of them. And so she joined them. in their death. Picture another day prior to this one, a day when two men stood on a mountain and they divided up the whole world, or at least the world that was important to them. The two men were Abraham and Lot. You see, Abraham's flocks and herds had grown so large, and Lot's flocks and herds had grown so large that there was not enough grass in any given plain to sustain them. God had blessed them, and they had a lot of stuff. And so they couldn't stay together because the arid nature of the land wouldn't feed enough to feed all the cattle. So they looked at each other, and Abraham said to Lot, "You pick. You make a choice. Where do you want to live?" And Lot looked around over all the plains, and he looked down to the plains of Sodom and Gomorrah and said, "You know, that's the best plains, the most well-watered, the best grass, the richest." And even though his uncle Abraham was the man of promise, and even though his uncle Abraham had the right to pick any place he wanted, Lot chose the best, and he went there to live. That choice led to another choice. He moved up close to Sodom. And that led to another choice. He moved in and began to live among the people. And that led to another choice. He began to become part of the people. And those series of choices placed Lot where he is today. On the other hand, Abraham made a choice too. He went in the other direction, and his choice was costly to him. It cost him cash because he was taking a less fertile plain. It cost him culture because he was not part of the city. He was going to be out on his own, a Bedouin, away from the culture of the town. It cost him the companionship of those people. And yet now Abraham stands on the mountain and looks down and sees the possible potential result of a choice he could have made. And everything he has is intact, including his integrity. Where's Lot? Lot lost everything he'd hoped to gain. It's all gone up in smoke. It's gone. You see, he embraced the world and the culture. And what did it give him back? It gave him nothing in return. It's all gone. In the epilogue to this story, we hear an account that is sickening, adding to the brokenness of a broken man. But it's very instructive to us because it teaches us that our choices today also affect the generations to come. Notice verse 30. Lot and his two daughters left Zoar and settled in the mountains, for he was afraid to stay in Zoar. Now, that's strange. This guy's become so unstable. He wanted to go to Zoar because he couldn't make it to the mountains. So he went to Zoar. Now he's afraid to stay in Zoar, so he's going to go to the mountains. His life is gone. He and his two daughters lived in a cave. One day the older daughter said to the younger, "Our father is old. There's no man around here to lie with us, as is the custom all over the earth." Everybody everywhere in the earth has somebody to raise a family by. We don't. What are we going to do? Verse 32. "Let's get our father to drink wine and then lie with him, and preserve our family line through our father." That night they got their father to drink wine, and the older daughter went in and lay with him. He was not aware of it when she lay down or when she got up. The next day the older daughter said to the younger, "Last night I lay with my father. Let's get him to drink wine again tonight. You go in and lie with him so we can preserve our family line through our father." So they got their father to drink wine that night, and the younger daughter went and lay with him. Again, he was not aware of it when she lay down or when she got up. So both of Lot's daughters became pregnant by their father. The older daughter had a son, and she named him Moab. He is the father of the Moabites today. The younger daughter also had a son, and she named him Ben-Ammim. He is the father of the Ammonites of today. Two very instructive names. The name Moab is Hebrew from "of the father." The name Ben-Ammim means "son of a near kinsman." Two children born of incestuous relationships with Lot who will carry those names as a reminder for the rest of their life. And the Moabites and the Ammonites are going to be the enemies of the nation of Israel. Here's a man who has reached the bottom. And, as you might say, well, what is wrong with those two girls? Don't they know any better than that? Remember, it was their dad who offered them to the crowd. Now, what would you expect from them? What would you expect? In the same way, when we make choices to serve the world, and give our lives to the culture around us for whatever we might get out of it, don't you think that little eyes are watching? And little ears are listening. And what you do in moderation, your kids have an incredible tendency to do in excess. So if you choose to live your life for stuff other than God, people are watching that. Little people who are forming values about life. What did Lot do? He made a tough choice. He chose to satisfy himself and get the stuff in this life, and that left him. Left him with nothing. Abraham, on the other hand, chose to be obedient to God and follow him no matter what. And in the end, we see two men, one with nothing and one with the promise of God and everything else. I just think it's so easy for us to look at the culture around us and look at the things that are important to it and embrace those things. If I can work just a little harder, if I can climb a little bit more, if I can get a little bit more gratification, if I can do those things, eventually it'll pay off for me. But does the payoff have eternal significance? Will it last long term? Or is the payoff something temporary? If I can just embrace this relationship because it makes me feel good, and it may cost me something like my family, but it's doing something for me now. What's the long-term payoff? Just so many choices to make. There's a lot to see in Sodom. There's a Bill and a Joe and a Susie and a Jane to see in Austin. And the reason why the world has so much trouble seeing those faces is because we're wearing the same masks that they wear. Let's make choices to live the life of faith in the face of a culture that hates it. Because in the end, none of those things that our culture holds dear will ultimately survive the test of God's judgment. But the person of faith will last forever. Jim Elliot, missionary who was martyred, taking the gospel to a group of savage Indians, once made the statement, "He is no fool who gives what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose." He is no fool who gives what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose. You know where Jim Elliot got that? From someone infinitely more wise than him, Jesus Christ, when Jesus said, "What will a person gain if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? Or what will we give in exchange for our lives?" What will we give? The life of faith says, "I'm going to embrace God and be faithful to Him, and the culture is not where I am going to live. I'm not going to blend in here. I'm not going to be part of this. I'm going to do what God calls me to do." Let's bow our heads. Father in heaven, you're a God of grace. If you weren't, none of us would be here. But you're also God of judgment. Just as it may be, there will be a reckoning for the deeds committed in this community.